The Guardian.
If you're a fan of British independent cinema, here's an offer from Guardian Film you won't want to miss. Right now on guardian.co.uk, you can watch the award-winning film Skeletons starring Jason Isaacs, and you can save 10% just for being a podcast listener. Skeletons is a story of a pair of travelling psychic detectives helping people remove the metaphysical skeletons from their closets. It's eccentric, heartfelt, and very, very funny. The film costs just £3.49 to stream or £5.49 to download. And you can save a further 10% by entering the promotion code SAVEME. To check out the trailer and to find out more, head to guardian.co.uk/skeletons.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. From I'm so sorry to if you don't like us, vote Labour in less than a week. Nick Clegg's rain-soaked conference swan song wrapped up this week with a promise to keep calm and carry on cutting. But with his colleagues openly flirting with Labour, can he keep everybody facing in the right direction? Also this week, they say you can't buy class, but manners cost nothing. Gate rumbles on as the Tory chief whip apologises for abusing a police officer in Downing Street, but doesn't quite deny calling him a pleb. And how will Labour fare at their party conference in Manchester next week? Can they fill in the blank piece of policy paper? Joining me to discuss all of this, we have Nick Cohen from The Observer, Michael White from The Guardian, and the academic Lib Dem policy wonk and part-time troublemaker for Nick Clegg, Richard Grayson. A warm welcome to you all. Well, party conferences are rarely the make-or-break showdowns that the media likes to talk up, and a downbeat get-together in Brighton this week was no exception. Nick Clegg rounded off an unremarkable week by the seaside with a message of resilience.
The choice between the party we were and the party we are becoming is a false one. The past is gone, and it isn't coming back. If voters want a party of opposition, a stop-the-world-I-want-to-get-off party, they've got plenty of options. But we are not one of them. There's a better, more meaningful future waiting for us.
Well, our own Michael White has been down in Brighton all week and caught up with delegates as they tried to escape onto the blustery seafront.
I thought it was a very inspiring speech, actually.
What did you like particular?
I liked particularly the fact that we are taking responsibility for actually being in government and being quite active and proactive, rather than just as in opposition we were just generally talking about things we wanted to change. We're actually now in a position to do something about it.
That's what he was trying to tell you, but it's quite tough, isn't it? It's a bit of a miserable speech.
No, I don't think it was miserable at all. Okay. I don't know what your expectations were, but I thought it summed
up. Leader speeches at conferences tend to try and sort of lift the mood of the party, but he kept saying there's more austerity to come, no magic bullets. He laughed at Ed Balls and mocked the Tories. You cheered the bit where he mocked the Tories.
Absolutely, because I think we are representing people. This is a democracy. We are representing people. It would be most amiss of us if we were trying to pretend that we had the answers to everything, that the future was going to be very easy. It's not. There's lots of tough decisions.
Here's an old friend of mine, Mrs. Moore. Your husband Richard is here.
He's following.
He used to be Jeremy Thorpe's advisor. Their son Charles Moore, of course, used to be editor of the Daily Telegraph, but that's another story. Now, Mrs. Moore, what do you think of that?
Well, I thought it was quite good, but I'm much more interested in knowing what you thought.
Well, I thought it was a difficult speech for a difficult audience at a difficult time. No, but I'm here to ask what you thought. What did you like about it?
What I liked about it, I thought it was quite well delivered and quite well constructed. What I was regretted about it was nothing about Europe, and I think we should have stood up for that.
He made a reference to rebuilding the economy inside the world's largest single market, and I thought that's his way of mentioning Europe without mentioning it.
Nobody would know what he was talking about, you see.
Now, you're a keen European, aren't you?
Yes.
Yes, that boy of yours, it didn't turn out that way, did we? We're not talking about that today. Lovely to see you, thank you. Graham Bishop, who understands economics, what did you think about that?
I was enormously impressed. I mean, he's really explained to everyone that these are tough times, and they have been tough, and they're going to be tough, and there's no way around it. And just dreaming about waving magic wands is just a dream.
Well, you were telling me the other day that Britain's annual deficit expenditure over income was much higher than Greece, Spain, or even Portugal. I went away and looked it up. This year it's 8.3%, a bit higher than either of us thought, I think.
It's higher than Italy, and it's about the same as Spain.
Okay, so if we lose confidence in the markets, this was your argument.
Yeah.
He seemed to be echoing it in there, didn't he?
Yes, absolutely.
We're in big trouble, because they'll push our interest rates up.
Yeah, they would. Yeah,
so you were satisfied with your austerity hair shirt on, that he squared up to the reality of the plight we're in?
Well, of course, one would definitely like not to have the austerity. We should never have ever been left in this situation.
Right, let's go and find Simon Hoggett, the Guardian sketchwriter, who was watching Nick Clegg's speech, and we'll have his usual trenchant verdict.
I thought the interesting thing was that the most applause he got, the biggest cheer, was when he announced that Paddy Ashton was coming back. People absolutely loved that, because, of course, it took them back to an older, simpler, happier time when they were in opposition, when they hated both the Tories and the Labour Party. They were always able to be like lonely schoolboys in their bedrooms working out an exact plan for how you should run Britain without any of the compromises and the difficulties and the tough decisions that have to be made when you're actually in government. It was quite cleverly to blend together the old past of the party, its permanent opposition, its existence in a kind of fantasy world, with the realities of today, by saying that the people who had in the darkest times, when they only had a handful of MPs and everyone laughed at them, were somehow the giants on which today's Liberal Democrats stood, who are now actually in government thanks to the efforts of those in the past. It's quite cunningly done. Whether it'll mean anything or not, I don't know. There were one or two jokes. Yes, he said that Boris Johnson, for example, had written a very approving article about him in the Daily Telegraph earlier this week. He said, well, at least there's one party leader that Boris Johnson doesn't mind supporting. And that's a reference to Boris's constant attacks on David Cameron. That went down well too.
The Guardian sketch writer Simon Hoggett there. So, Richard, this year, more than most, when you walked around the party fringes, there was an air of despondency, I thought. I know you weren't there, but there did also seem to be a bit of a philosophical argument about what the party was for.
I think the party generally is quite resigned to what's going on. I think they buy the argument that Nick puts forward about there being difficult decisions to make. And of course, this is where the party's democracy has actually helped the leadership, because the party signed up in really very large numbers back in 2010 to the coalition deal. And that's something that the leadership is able to turn round and say. Of course, there are some of us who have a different view, but I think we've long accepted since 2010 that we're in a minority.
And what's your sense of, is it a numbers game? Is it, as some people have suggested with Tony Blair after Iraq, that the awkward squad mostly resigned and therefore Nick Clegg doesn't need to worry about them anymore?
Well, I think some did. There's no doubt about that. But I think also, if you look at groups like the Social Liberal Forum, which could have been a bit more awkward than they have been, the decision they've taken tactically is to try and influence policy while in government, I would argue in very, very marginal ways.
I mean, it seemed to me that people were more interested now in writing the manifesto for 2015. The phrase I kept hearing time and again going around the conference was, well, we're in the second half of a parliament now, as if there was almost no point in trying to influence the government anymore. And it was really about, you know, what you get in the next manifesto.
Well, clearly that is important. But of course, you have to remember that going into an election, the public will be thinking about what has happened in public policy terms over the course of a 5-year parliament, but also the things in most recent memory. So to give up now and just focus on the manifesto, I think, is doesn't make very much sense.
Now, Nick, Nick Clegg's speech, slightly grumpily reviewed by The Guardian, but generally hailed by most of the other...
Wasn't a bad speech at all.
...papers. Assertion, as he'd see it, as classical liberalism. But then there was this defeat at the beginning of the week on secret courts for the leadership.
Well, yes.
Does it seem to you a classically liberal party now?
In a way, yes. I mean, you still have to say on civil liberties that if you're worried about civil liberties, you'll probably get a fairer hearing from the Lib Dems than any other party. Although, as well as secret courts, there also has a Home Office, Liberal Home Office minister berating me for writing about this. There's this a proposal to tap the whole internet and the new communications bill that's coming up, which is a big test for civil libertarians. But I rather agreed with you, Tom. I found people... I'm a bit of an outsider to this world. I don't really understand Liberal Democrats. It was the first time I'd stayed there at the conference for a long time. And they were clearly centre-left people, and they were clearly, on the whole, pretty glum. Resigned is perhaps a nicer way of saying it, but I kept thinking of their alliance with the Tories. I kept thinking of Socrates' description of the male libido. It's like being chained to a lunatic, and I thought many liberals felt the same about being chained to the Conservative Party.
Mike, where do you think they are on strategy? We had this extraordinary briefing from Nick Clegg's people just before the big speech that if you want to be an awkward squad left-wing protest voter, then go elsewhere. I'm not sure where they're meant to go, but I mean, there's a kind of glorious defiance, I suppose, in not seeming to be too bothered about compromises with the electorate.
Well, I think that's a familiar tactic. Bob Marshall Andrews, does any older listener remember him? Labour MP for one of the Medway towns. Whenever he encountered a racist in Rochester, which he did from time to time, he'd say, "I don't want your vote. I forbid you to vote for me. I shall vote for you if I want to, Mr. Marshall Andrews." "No, you won't. You mustn't vote for me. I forbid you." And it was quite a successful tactic, so do bear that in mind. But I thought Clegg made not a bad job. He's a dull speaker, but it's a dreadful situation we're in. And he told them that things are nasty and they're going to get worse. And it isn't just our problem. It's Europe's problem. It's America's problem. And the Asian economies are coming up like Mo Farah on the outside lane. And boy, it's going to be tough. But we're the honest people. Nick says, what are Lib Dems for? Well, They still worship at the shrine of John Stuart Mill. And Clegg actually quoted, I think it's Mill, in his speech, I heard it several times this week, that people should have the opportunity and liberty to live their own best lives in their own way. And that, they're the party of liberty. Tories are the party of the market. Labour's the party of the state. And that's where they place themselves. It's all very highfalutin, but... You know, a few days at the Liberal Conference, you can see what they're driving at, even though, as somebody said, Professor, what's he called, used to be the David Howarth, used to be the MP for Cambridge, said, well, if you're on the side of the poor and against the state, you're oppressing them pretty hard in this coalition.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I guess, sums up your position, is it, Richard?
Yes, it does. And I think Nick's taking a very limited view of what's possible as well when he essentially talks about there being no alternative. It's a very governmental kind of view that you can never aim for something much, much better. And in fact, it's an argument for much of what the previous Labour government did. It's an argument that they were in government and making difficult decisions in difficult times. And a lot of our critique at the time was about being more ambitious in a whole range of public policy areas, as well as, of course, being critical of them on civil liberties. And I just think that to suggest that anybody who has a slightly more ambitious view than Nick does simply wants the world to stop is very misconceived.
I mean, isn't there a real problem here just in political process terms, Nick, which is, if the what used to be called the Blairites prevail in Labour, mm-hmm. we don't know how that will turn out, but definitely with the Liberals now, as well as the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats, sort of talking about grown-up politics, trade-offs, hard choices. There is a very large section of the electorate that, whether those choices are inevitable or not, doesn't want to hear them and doesn't want to make them and wants to vote against things and not for things.
Well, which may be, we were talking about this before we came on there, this may be a big problem for Liberal Democrats at the next election. When they say to their vote, to their left voters, for want of a better phrase, "We don't want you anymore. We don't like you. We don't want your support." What is going to happen in southern English seats, say, or Scottish and Welsh border seats, where in the past people who were left wing, rather than vote Labour, would vote Lib Dem to stop the Tory winning? Are they now going to vote for lesser of two evils, if you like? Or are they going to say, actually, after your cohabitation with the Conservatives, we want nothing to do with evil in any of its manifestations. I will vote for whoever I want. Labour, Green, I don't care. I don't care if it's a wasted vote because you took my goodwill before and let me down very badly. There's a rather... I don't support Nick Clegg or whatever, but there's a rather ugly atmosphere around him now on the left. It's a bit like Tony Blair, where it is impossible to say a good word about Tony Blair on the left. It's the same with Nick Clegg. It's irrational. It's a bit Daily Mail of the left in the sort of ferocity of the hatred. But, I mean, that's a political fact. And I do wonder if, come the next election, if a candidate is out in the southwest or the Scottish borders and says to Labour voters, you've got to lend me your vote, if those Labour voters or left-wing voters will just flatly refuse now.
I mean, it's interesting that, and I'm sure, Richard, that one thing that helped Nick Clegg get through this week, and he did get through it very much intact, was the sort of fair-mindedness of Liberal Democrats who could see that Clegg is a hate figure. You know, in a way, he's more of a hate figure than Osborne and Cameron. Do you think that's right?
Well, I think there may be a sense that people are keeping him as a kind of human shield. But actually, I mean, from my point, I don't really think Nick's the problem. There's actually, it's the agenda that has been signed up for. It's essentially a centre-right Liberal agenda. The leadership as a whole, of which Vince's part, has taken that on. People like Tim Farron, who posture as being on the left but back the leadership at every available opportunity and have done for many years, are no different to that. So, you know, where's really the viable alternative centre-left leader?
Of course
that's
there isn't
a particular
one.
Problem.
That's why old Cleggy can sleep soundly in his bed.
Absolutely right.
So I was shocked, Michael. I don't know if you noticed this or heard this, that when I spoke to senior Lib Dems in private, they really disliked Vince Cable. They didn't seem to have much support among the parliamentary party at all.
Well, that's true. That's because he's not a good colleague. Hmm. And when he goes on to Newsnight the other day and says, well, of course, I was against the tuition fees policy, but I went along with it. Well, that's not good collegiate behaviour. A proper grown-up defends things he may not have agreed with, but publicly endorsed. And Vince often fails that test, and that's been around for years. But the voters like this sort of melancholy Jeremiah stuff. Nobody does miserableism better than Vince, but he's always the star of his own show, and that's noted by the colleagues. Paddy Ashdown's been going around Brighton saying Clegg is the best leader for 100 years, which takes out Joe Grimm and Lloyd George, I think to remember he vaguely helped win World War I, and a host of other people. So there you go. But Paddy was always an enthusiast for the moment, always surfing the wave. One other thing, I think we underestimate the capacity of Lib Dems, who are good at pavement politics, to dig into their constituencies and hang on in there.
You need members for pavement politics, though, Michael.
You need
a strong local membership if you're going to do pavement politics properly. And
yeah.
Liberal Association membership is falling quite.
Yeah, they're down to their core, but the core is still a core in both senses of the word.
Can I just ask, Mike, I deliberately went in on the philosophy and not just will Nick Clegg survive, how much trouble he's in. You know, we had all these polls saying they'd do better with Vince. Maybe they'd even do better with someone no one's ever heard of, like Norman Lamb. But
no, they wouldn't. Norman's a dear man, but steady on.
Okay. Well, I'll park that thought. But okay, maybe the Tim Farron, who Richard's been criticising.
And he's a rascal, as has already been pointed out.
But maybe they'd do better with A.N. Other, who knows? Or maybe they wouldn't. But if there's the perception they would, do you think Nick Clegg... does Nick Clegg want to be leader in 2015? And do you think he will be?
I think his clear indication, he wants to take them into the he doesn't want to pull out of the coalition before election day. I thought that might be an option. I also thought they might pick another leader, but as we've all agreed, they haven't got another leader. And so I think he'll want to take them into the coalition and see what happens, because one of the, do you remember Paddy Ashdown's equidistancing speech in Chard in Somerset all those years ago? He was more even-handed in his abuse of both his major rivals. He said, of course, it's a three-party system now, three governing alternatives, but obviously they can't govern alone. So he's not the best man to take them into a switch with Labour if Labour were to emerge from the next election, heaven knows if it will, as the largest party. But that would be for the time for him to go. I don't think he'll be sorry to leave politics. He's gone much further than he must have expected. He'd probably go to, let's say, the European Commission, where his many languages
will come in handy,
won't they?
If he was going to do do that, it would have to be in 2014, wouldn't it?
No, it wouldn't. No, it wouldn't. Oh. He could wait and see for the... I'm making this up as we go along in this conversation. He'd wait and see the election results. The election results pointed to a Lib-Lab coalition. He would say, I'm not the man to lead this. Time for somebody else to take the bowling and disappear.
What do you think, Richard?
I think at the moment, I think Mike's right. I think it's most likely that he will go on to the next election, partly because I don't see the issue on which the party will challenge him, and I don't think he will step down. But the secret courts issue is something that could change the political dynamics within the party.
Let's just focus on that for a second, because this was fascinating. We've had lots of these things before where the voluntary Liberal Democrat Party has made a stand on the health bill. Let's get rid of, what was it called, duty to promote competition. But it came up with this very typical Lib Dem list of 19 points they wanted changed from Evan Harris, and then there was lots of negotiations about what they meant. The motion that was passed overwhelmingly by conference this week just said, get rid of the whole of Section 2 of this bill. A bit harder to compromise on that, Richard.
I think it is, but I think it also points to an area where part of the problem that we have with the current leadership is their willingness to sign up to Tory policies without even challenging them in the first place. Now, actually, if it would have been a good opportunity, actually, for Nick to say to the Tories, yes, well, of course, we'll sign up to that now, but we're going to have to take it to our conference, and that could be very complicated. And actually to take that vote back to David Cameron and say, look, sorry, I'm under huge pressure here. I can't now go along with this. And you would have thought, if he was going to do that, that his speech yesterday would have been an opportunity to flag it.
But there wasn't a nod, was there?
No, there wasn't a nod. He completely sidestepped the issue. And it's just one of the many issues, like the NHS reforms, where I just don't think the leadership gets what the party stands for.
And interestingly, that is on a question of civil liberties and
absolutely
and
fundamental
the side of things.
I mean, they completely misjudged where the party was coming from on the NHS by looking at some proposals that, from a centre-right Liberal perspective, looked perfectly reasonable, but weren't in tune with where most of the party is on the issue of the state and on public services. On this, it's more inexplicable that the alarm bells haven't been ringing from day one. And I really would have expected Nick to use the conference vote to negotiate with the government and to flag that from day one and to strengthen his own leadership of the party. But he hasn't done that. Very odd.
Just, Mike, finally on this, before we move on, do you see an easy negotiated way out of this, or do you think this secret courts thing is going to be a running sore now?
Well, it will be a running sore, and the civil liberties lobby isn't always right. I haven't spent enough time studying this issue. I'll be frank, I haven't made up my mind. The Guardian had a leader this week, which I haven't yet read, on secret courts. I don't like secret courts, and I'm opposed to them, but there are one or two occasions when these things no doubt are justified in the larger public interest. And it's a great rallying cry, civil liberties always is for the Lib Dems, as Richard says. But you've got to remember, if you break up a government over this or any other issue, NHS reforms, then the voters are going to say, why have you done this? And the party which does it is likely to pay an even larger penalty than it may be lining up to pay
in the not-so-secret court of public opinion. If the manners were impeccable all week in Brighton, those of the Conservative chief whip were under close scrutiny in Westminster. The police report into what inevitably was called Gategate says that Andrew Mitchell called an officer a pleb during an argument about which exit he could wheel his bike through on Downing Street. Nick Cohen, abusing police officers, never popular, but with the twist of the language of class for the government, do you think it's poisonous for the government?
Yes, in a small way. I mean, obviously, you know, this isn't going to stay in people's minds, but it reinforces a picture off the top of the Conservative Party, a satirical picture, if you like, a cartoon picture, which is lodging in voters' minds quite deeply, I think.
And yet we've got Boris... I mean, Boris Johnson hasn't done that, but Boris Johnson's so popular and so posh.
It's very odd class in Britain. You know, there's a reason why English novelists just lose themselves in it for their whole writing careers, is that the ideal, particularly in England, but to less extent has gotten in Wales as well, the ideal remains of the English gentleman. Hugh Grant or Tony Blair when he was young. Public schoolboys. Tony Blair went to the Eton of Scotland. You hardly say he'd had a deprived upbringing, but they loved him. Boris Johnson, who does it with a common touch. As long as you're seen as a gentleman with some noblesse oblige, I think you're right in Britain for all the talk about the masses disdaining the elites. But as soon as you're seen as something like the wicked squire or the man who treats the laurels with contempt, it's a fatal image to get in voters' minds.
So unfathomable, but pretty serious, Richard.
Well, it does reinforce the picture, as Nick says. I think one of the problems with class in politics is it's actually very difficult to debate, because people start accusing you of inverse snobbery or having chips on your shoulder if you try to raise it, which do exist. But I mean, just thinking about my own campaigning, I just feel that, you know, having grown up in a new town and gone to a comprehensive school, I just have very different life experiences to a very large number of the cabinet, and I think that makes a difference on the kinds of issues you will raise, the kinds of ways you will approach public policy. Now, of course, people can get out of their experience and can transcend their experience. There are lots of people, you know, with very privileged upbringings who've been completely in touch with the mood of the public. But it's just something that is difficult to talk about, because it leads to generalisations. And I think we need to recognise that there is, though, a problem with our with the elite of our politics, which is overwhelmingly drawn from a very small section of society, and that leads to unrepresentative views and occasionally the kinds of outbursts that we've seen from Andrew Mitchell.
Mike, no one apart from people like us had heard of Andrew Mitchell before, and do you think they'll have forgotten who he is quite soon, or do you think this will linger?
Well, everybody's heard of Francis Urquhart, the chief whip in Michael Dobbs's famous series. Mitchell's an odd character, and when I heard he had allegedly done this, well, who do you choose, a politician or a copper's word on these things? In current times, it's not easy to make that call, and I wouldn't be certain that the tabloid version is right. The Sun's version, my God, who do you believe the Sun either? What a mess. But it plays to an aspect of Mitchell's character. Heaven knows where he thinks he gets all this from. He went to rugby school, the same as Salman Rushdie. He's another obnoxious, overpaid fellow.
He's a very brave man who put on his life on the line for the freedoms you take for granted.
We'll talk about that another time. Nick, you've had your turn. I agree with the others. It plays to the stereotype. Of course, a lot of Tories will be scandalised by Mitchell's behaviour. He wants we read in the Mail, he wants the whip's office run on officer's mess lines, not sergeant's mess, as he dismissively spoke of his predecessor, Patrick McLaughlin, former miner, very nice man indeed, doesn't swear at anybody. So this was not officer's mess behaviour on Mitchell's own terms. Bad for Dave.
Very quickly on Dave himself. He was classically educated, of course, but didn't do as well as he might have done on Letterman last night.
Well, you'd have thought he'd have made a shot at Magna, wouldn't you?
First of all, a rural Britannia.
Yeah.
Written by whom? I mean, it's the iconic association with the British Empire. Britain rules the world. Who wrote that? Do you know?
God, you're testing me there. Elgar, I'll go for.
Okay. Edward Elgar?
I reckon, but...
We can check it. Yeah. And the literal translation was what? You have Magna...
Again, you're testing me.
Boy, it'd be good if you knew this.
Yeah, well, it would be. That's not a good start.
No, you're fine. I'm just being the idiot. I'm really ignorant. No.
You've found me out.
No, good heavens. Magna Carta literally means Great Charter. The Great Charter. And as we pointed out, the seeds of democracy. Rural Britannia, which is a beautiful refrain, based on a poem by James Thompson. Are you familiar with James Thompson?
Well, I am not.
You don't know who wrote Rural Britannia.
Yeah, that's bad. That is. I've ended my career on your show.
You
tonight,
do know so Texas and Nebraska.
Well, that's
that's pretty good.
As Tony Hancock said, "Magna Carta, did you die in vain?"
And we've just got 2 minutes now to look forward to the Labour conference. Nick, are you going?
Well, no. There's a cuts rule at the Observer, and you're only allowed to go to two of the free conferences.
Oh, I see.
So I thought I'd go to the people in power rather than the people out of power.
I see.
I think that's Sky breaking news. A cuts regime. Thank goodness we may all be saved.
But what are you looking out for? I mean, it's not. I think we can officially say it's not make or break week for Ed Miliband, can't we? Because although his personal ratings aren't great, he's storming ahead. His party's storming ahead, so they're not going to knife their leader right now, are they, Mike?
Well, it's not storming ahead. If you listen to the number crunchers, in the present state of the coalition, Labour ought to be much further ahead. I think the general feeling is that Ed isn't doing anything much wrong, but he's not doing the business with the voters or with the issues, and he has Ed Balls at his shoulder to remind the voters, if David Cameron and Nick Clegg weren't already busy doing it, that Labour played a significant part in creating our financial plight. So, no, Ed Miliband's got at least as much to worry about as the other two, and at least they're in power.
So, and Richard, finally, if I can unfairly abuse you by suggesting you stand for the section of the electorate that's, you know, liberally minded but disgruntled with the coalition, what do you want to hear from Ed Miliband? What two or three things could he say this week that would actually start to win?
I think actually the big question for Labour is where is the policy review going? What's going to start to come out of it? The blank page that was talked about, when is it going to be written on? And I think now that, for example, John Cruddas has been involved in the review for some time, he's got an article in the New Statesman today about social policy, which could be interesting. I haven't read it yet, but it's sort of looking at what the people involved in the policy review are coming out with, because there is a big question, I think, about how is Labour going to be different if it's back in government? And, you know, voters are not prepared to trust parties until they have some idea of what the party would do differently, and that's really not clear at the moment.
Because you'd say so far, wouldn't you, Nick, about Ed Miliband, it's been a different tone, you know, on predatory capitalism, don't like it, but there's not been much bite.
Well, on the one hand, he's saying that the crash has changed everything, which is true. But on the other hand, he's not saying, or perhaps I'm being unfair, perhaps I haven't been listening closely enough, he's not saying that if Labour get back into power in 2015, which is at least possible, they will have to take some very nasty decisions. There's not enough of, if you like, the blood, sweat, toil and tears coming through. And we will concentrate on these areas to revive the economy, to renew the economy, but inevitably other things we would like to do, other things people who are voting Labour expect a Labour government to do, we won't be able to do. And in a funny way, I think if Labour doesn't start saying that quite loudly, they might be found out during a general election.
And you
campaign.
Think even now, not you could? I mean, maybe the game plan is to do that in a year or two's time.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know, but I think constantly emphasising how difficult the situation is for Britain is not about, one, it'd be true if they were to come into power tomorrow, but two, it's not about political strategy either.
OK, well, we'll leave that there. My thanks to Mike White, to Richard Grayson and to Nick Cohen. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
If you're a fan of British independent cinema, here's an offer from Guardian Film you won't want to miss. Right now on guardian.co.uk, you can watch the award-winning film Skeletons, starring Jason Isaacs, and you can save 10% just for being a podcast listener. Skeletons is a story of a pair of travelling psychic detectives helping people remove the metaphysical skeletons from their closets. It's eccentric, heartfelt, and very, very funny. The film costs just £3.49 to stream or £5.49 to download. And you can save a further 10% by entering the promotion code SAVEME. To check out the trailer and to find out more, head to guardian.co.uk/skeletons.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.